Okay, we resume our meeting. We're going to be introduced to the wondrous world of macrohedging. Kumaras Gupta is our new FI man, and he's heading the FI team. Please.
Kevin's looking a lot better, isn't he?
Good morning. It's the greatest pleasure for Jane and me to explain about this difficult but exciting project, accounting for macro hedging. Please have a look at page 2. Let me explain briefly the project overview. The project of the accounting for macro hedging focuses on accounting for open portfolios that are dynamically managed. Open here means exposures within the portfolio will constantly change over time. Accordingly, risk management is usually performed dynamically on an open portfolio basis. Let me come back to this issue again later. Given the dynamic nature of the risk management, static hedge accounting solutions that require a specific linkage between hedged items, what is hedged, and hedging derivatives, what is hedging, don't provide a good accounting solution. In addition, if exposures change frequently, this will result in frequent designations, discontinuations, and redesignations under hedge accounting. This is operationally difficult and does not necessarily reflect actual risk management. It's true that the majority of discussions so far have been on interest rate risk for banks, because this is a well-known example where there is a need for a revised accounting model for macro hedging. However, it was always the intention of the board to try to develop a model that was not solely applicable for interest rate risk management by banks. The expectation of the board is that the approach should be applicable for other risks and other industries as well. Further outreach would be needed with a variety of industries once the forthcoming discussion paper has been issued. Please go on to the page 3. Here, let me explain briefly how banks typically manage interest rate risk dynamically. In the asset side, left-hand side, banks usually have multiple types of exposures, such as mortgages, corporate loans, bonds. Each of them is managed as a portfolio, in that each portfolio is made up of many items. You may want to call each of them as a sub-portfolio. Each of the sub-portfolio is usually open, in that new exposures are continuously added and existing exposures expire. Please note, in the case of the mortgage portfolio, for instance, existing loans are frequently prepaid even before the maturity. This is one of the challenging aspects of our project. In the liability side, banks also have multiple types of exposures, such as demand deposits, time deposits, and debts issued. What is important here is when risk managers in banks consider risk management activities using derivatives such as interest rate swaps, they typically don't focus on one-to-one relationships between what is hedged and what is hedging. Rather, they assess risk exposures between assets and liabilities on a net basis. In addition, this type of risk management is very dynamic, with continuous, for example, daily monitoring of the net or residual risk within the entire portfolio and corresponding reassessment of required hedging activities. In other words, offsetting positions from exposures and existing derivatives are considered in contemplation of each other with a focus on the residual net risk position. Yeah, please.
Okay, please go on to slide four. The model that's been developed through the board discussions has been called the portfolio revaluation approach. And the model itself is actually quite simple, believe it or not. The difficulties come when you look at how you apply it to the different items and what you apply it to. But at the simplest level, the portfolio revaluation approach is that you revalue the portfolio that you are dynamically managing. So all the exposures that you are consider for dynamic risk management, you would revalue those for the changes in the managed risk, which in the main example within the discussion paper is going to be interest rate risk for the banking book portfolio. There's no proposal to change the accounting for hedging instruments. They would remain at fair value through P&L. And so the outcome of the portfolio revaluation model is that the P&L offset occurs naturally from the revaluation of the exposures for the hedged risk and the fair value changes of your actual derivatives. So where economic offset exists, then that should be reflected by offset in the profit and loss. One of the advantages of this model is that there is no requirement to be able to link individual derivatives to individual exposures. The portfolio itself is revalued and the derivatives are also at fair value. So this takes us away from this need to link things and the need to pretend it's a static relationship when actually it's not. So I think now we'll go on to a bit more detail about what we mean about a revaluation. As I've just said, the essence of the portfolio revaluation approach is that the portfolio is revalued. But the way in which the portfolio is revalued is by revaluing the individual exposures within that portfolio for the managed risk. So in this example here, we've got, but this is just one example of a loan that might be within the portfolio. So here you've got a 5% kind of coupon payable on a loan to a customer. 2% of that is the credit spread. That will continue to be managed by the business unit. That is, does not normally form part of the interest rate management. What would form part of the interest rate management would be the 3% market interest rate. So for the revaluation purposes, you would take the 3% coupon and you would revalue that on an NPV basis for changes in that market interest rate. So on day one, when this loan is included within the portfolio revaluation, you would have a 3% coupon instrument, and that would be discounted at the market rate, which would also be 3%. So your starting point would be a kind of a par or a par instrument. There would be no revaluation effect on day one. But then as market interest rates change, the relative value of that 3% coupon will change, and then obviously that will result in a revaluation adjustment. And as I said before, that change in value of your managed exposure with respect to interest rate risk should be offset by the fair value of the derivatives that you're using to hedge that, where offset exists, obviously. And I also want to say that the 2% credit spread, which I said is not part of the risk management, that obviously still needs to be accounted for, but that remains accounted for as you would ordinarily under IFRS 9. If we now move on to the next slide, slide six, this slide provides an overview of what the portfolio revaluation approach might look like, building on what we've just been saying. So on the left-hand side, you can see that of the graph, you can see that this is the default accounting for kind of dynamic risk management with derivatives. So in terms of the revaluation P&L, which is what this graph demonstrates, you've just got 25 of revaluation P&L from the derivatives at fair value. And arguably that's not a good representation of the risk management, because those derivatives have used to manage kind of future net interest income. So on the right-hand side, this is what the effect of the portfolio of revaluation approach will give you. You've still got your 25 of fair value changes for the derivative. That doesn't change. But in addition, you revalue all your assets that you managed as part of this portfolio for interest rate risk, and you revalue all your liabilities that you manage for interest rate risk as part of this portfolio. And the net effect is that you have a residual volatility in this example, which is 4. And so the 4 that you now have, the residual revaluation volatility, should be representative of some remaining risk within that managed portfolio. So rather than it being an arbitrary accounting kind of volatility, the plan is, hope is that that actually is meaningful and representative of risk management.
Okay. As Jane explained, the basic idea of the portfolio revaluation approach is simple, but big question for us. One of the key considerations for the application of the portfolio revaluation approach is what to be revalued. In other words, the scope of the application. Please have a look at page 7. We prepared 4 scenarios. Let me start from scenario 2. Scenario 2 reflects the holistic view, in that the approach should be applied consistently with the existence of dynamic risk management. This alternative arguably provides risk management inconsistent with risk management, as the scope of both accounting and risk management is the same. However, questions have been raised as to whether the revaluation effect from intentionally unhedged positions is relevant to the current year reported profit or loss. So if you have a look at scenario 2 in the page 7, it is true that the part is dynamically managed, but it does not necessarily mean all of the exposures are intentionally hedged by risk managers. So this is one of the challenges. Scenario 1 is, in a sense, more holistic than scenario 2, such that if interest rate risk is dynamically managed somewhere within a group, then the approach should be applied whenever that risk exists, even including items that are not dynamically risk managed. Scenario 3 allows an element of choice, such that the approach can be applied to sub-portfolios within the wider dynamically managed portfolio. The challenge of this approach is that it is unlikely to present a full picture of the risk management if the risk management considers all sub-portfolios in contemplation of each other. Scenario 4, the proportional approach. For example, where a bank hedges, say, 80% of the identified risk, then the approach is applied proportionally to 80% of the whole dynamically managed portfolio. The challenge of this approach would be operationally difficult. If the percentage were to change over time, which ordinarily would be a frequent and quick occurrence. There is also the question as to whether the approach should be optional or mandatory. With this, I want to turn the discussions to the participants. Thank you very much.
So just a quick thing before we start off. I know we have given you a pretty high-level overview. The objective is to get your questions to us on, one, the understanding of what the model, what we are proposing, is working. And secondly, to give you a flavor of what we are planning to put in the discussion paper. But also another critical thing, what we would really like to get out of the session is, what do you all think should be the questions we should be asking in the DP? Because this is quite a variation from normal hedge accounting. And just another point in this regard is that the intent of the board is not to restrict this for just interest rate risk. So idea is it should be applicable for other risks, but we haven't got much traction from constituents on that as of now. So what do you all think should be included, and if so, how? So would be grateful if y'all could keep that in perspective as well.
Alessandro? Three things. The first of all, I believe it's an enormous advance, so it's really welcome, sort of standard. I believe that a lot of things here will be on the efficiency. How do you measure efficiency in that sense? And I believe one question that arises all the time is, let me take, for example, that we start with a managed Well, the net exposure is 100 million, for example. And you start the day with a swap of 100 million notional base. So we start with the same notional basis. But of course, during the day, the exposure changes a lot. So you can end up with two situations. I believe the first one is easier when you have the derivative position, which is smaller than your actual risk exposure. So I understand that you're going to measure efficiency based on the total derivative position against this exposure, because the derivative position it's lower than the actual exposure. Second one is a bit trickier. When you end up with a derivative position that is larger, for example, in my example here, 100 million, hedging a 90 million position, which is temporary. So you say, no, I'm not going to close this derivative position because I have a fluctuation in my exposure. In my example here, 100 million becomes 110, becomes 90, becomes... How do I measure efficiency in that case? Would I measure based on an average? Can I use an average of the position? Do I have... Or I should conservatively always define in the derivative position as a lower bound?
The point of this model is that there isn't a need to kind of track and compare exposures to derivatives just for the purposes of accounting. And so if economically, for a period of time, the derivatives have been higher than the managed exposure, then you would revaluing the fair value of the derivatives as they were and fair value of the derivatives and revaluing the exposure, that mismatch for however long it was would be part of that volatility that we talked about. So there's no need to kind of artificially monitor
that can
stuff.
Be large. For example, I can have a 100 million position derivatives then become a 10 million exposure. Could I still call it hedge accounting? Doesn't seem hedge accounting.
Well, I mean, we're calling it accounting for dynamic risk management. And so if that is your risk management, then that is what the this model is trying to represent.
The exposure.
Yes, but can I call the 100 million hedge? Let's think about disclosure. What's my derivative position being used as a hedge? Is 100 million even my exposure? My average exposure during a period is 5 million?
I think that's part of the reason why, as Jane said, we don't call it hedge accounting as such. So we're not sort of designating the derivatives as being hedging instruments. Mm-hmm. So irrespective of what gets revalued in the macro model, the whole 100 million derivative, I think, in your example, would always be measured at fair value in the normal way. So that's always, there's no change there. But I think what you're hitting on is the scope question. So the question is, what do you have to revalue on the other side, if you like? Setting aside the derivative, that's always going to be at fair value. What do you include within the scope of what gets remeasured as part of this portfolio? And how fluid can that
But I have a problem.
How fluid can that be?
Because I have to disclose which is my derivative position designate, my hedge position. I cannot mix both. Imagine a company that's a non-financial company has to say that I'm using derivatives for a hedging purpose.
I think the important thing is whether or not we still use hedging, word of hedging, into our proposal. Actually, what we are proposing is not really hedge accounting. We are proposing the, if you have a look at page 2, accounting for open portfolio that is dynamically managed. That our proposal is just a new accounting concept for the portfolio risk management.
Yeah, but I only can revalue or fair value my hedging item and my hedged item if I have a
hedging item.
Otherwise, they're going to be amortized costs.
Yes, that's the scoping.
That's the first scope question.
Yeah.
The whole what we think the model will provide will be transparency on that, because at the moment, if you've got 100 million of derivatives, and there's depending how you use your actual hedge accounting, you could potentially mask the fact that you actually had 100 versus 5. Whereas this model, if that is part of your risk management strategy, then that will be transparent.
The 5 in this example will be eligible to revaluation.
But you will pick up that cost.
Sir?
you, if it is part and it's dynamically managed, we are not establishing in the center the 1:1 relationship like your 100 million of debt.
No, it's not 1:1, it's just...
Yeah. Hmm. So you will be eligible, but you will pick up the revaluation noise, which you would have picked up anyway for the 100 million, because you are have a derivative book, which is hugely overbalanced based on what you're trying to hedge. So the accounts will pick up the noise, but it is not something which will stop you designating or de-designating. Those aspects are taken away, because you are viewing this, the derivative book, as hedging a 10 million book. No, whether it's a hedge or not is a different issue. But what we are trying to do is the financial statements will pick up the impact of this relationship and the imbalance that comes up.
Yeah, but I will be able to continue to revalue those those loans.
As long as you meet.
Would originally be accounted for at amortized cost, even if there is a huge discrepancy between both.
Yeah. Yes. If that was part of your risk management
that's
strategy.
That's part of your strategy.
Well, what
then my suggestion to your third point, I think that needs to be clarified.
Yes.
I couldn't,
And actually, you raised a very important point. So what is the point of amortized cost? So if you look at page 7, and if you go to the case 1, so it's completely overriding at IFRS 9. So if we go down this path, so eventually we are saying, you know, for those companies who uses this macro hedge model, they completely give up IFRS 9.
But it's official, optional, isn't it?
Yeah. This
and of course, I can hedge macro hedge for a part of my portfolio, not for the full portfolio.
Yeah, that's the case.
That's the
three.
They're all questions.
Yeah.
All questions. We are not proposing anything yet. We are discussing.
Yeah, discuss.
No, so assuming the proposed model will be very easy.
But what was it that needed to be clarified that needs
just
to be clarified?
One thing. The scope is a critical question which you have asked on. What we are saying is one of the areas is not a full fair value. We will just revalue it for the
respect
to the risk that you are hedging. So we will not move it to a full fair value. So let's be clear about that. Second, wanted to clear one thing, make very clear. Board hasn't taken any decisions on this, and these are the questions that will be there in the DP for you to tell us.
Let me tell you the reason. I tried to do a mini field test of this with my team, and I propose I on purpose give to two different guys to see how they would look. And they came to me with completely different
answers.
The derivatives base. So no, I can only call 10 million as a hedge. No, I can call everything as a hedge. And absolutely informed person comes to very different conclusions.
I mean, the completely pure application of the model would be basically you need to remeasure your entire banking book, if you like. And anybody listening to this online will be having a heart attack, but your entire banking book for the interest rate risk, and then you'd be measuring your interest rate swaps. That would show very transparently the extent of interest rate gaps you've got in your open positions. That would be extremely transparent, but I think the feedback that we've got and the initial soundings that we've got is that's not really consistent with how the risk managers are thinking about it, because they haven't sought to manage all of the risk that way. And so that's why these different sort of scope alternatives are attempts to try and more closely align the risk management perspective, if you like, with the accounting transparency.
Yeah, but I believe that's related to my point originally, which is what fraction of the banking book do I have to designate ex ante?
It's open.
I think reading,
because otherwise
it's going to be open to enormous manipulation. The person after designated just to reach the relationship.
And the point that Yuji was touching on when he was talking about the alternative four of the scope, where you have these proportions.
The scope ideas has pros and cons.
Yeah. Mm.
So if you apply this approach to all banking book exposures, some users may find it useful because it includes all interest rate exposures. But some banks would say this is not in line with actual risk management because they don't necessarily manage all interest rate exposures dynamically. But when, if you go to the route, for example, scenario 3, as Sue said, there is some of the arbitral, you know, pickup. So if you pick up number 3 scenario, it would give you smaller volatility in profit or loss. However, it is also raised a big question. It is really the reflection of actual risk management.
But I think the other thing that just to mention on alternative three is that what we're proposing here is that in the identification of sub-portfolios, there's not an expectation that every month you would change which sub-portfolios are either in or out. The simplicity of this model is that, you know, as I said before, if you put things in when they've got par value and then you revalue them through their life, then the revaluation adjustments will naturally go away. But the minute you start putting things in one month and then the next month and then changing, then you get to this whole need for amortizations and tracking and stuff, which we're trying to move away from.
My view is that alternative one will not be improved over current practice because of probably people will not elect anything as an inheriting leadership. They just stay the way it is now.
I mean, option one is really there to explain what we mean by option two in some ways, is that we are saying it is what you are dynamically managing.
Roger.
Well, I think it's a really interesting approach. I would agree that it's hard to make people revalue portfolios they're not dynamically managing, or even risks in portfolios where they're perhaps dynamically managing interest rate risk. If you're not dynamically managing credit risk, but you could do, you'd be made to start revaluing something, you know, for things that you probably know or would actually be hedging. I think the second issue is it's easy valuing the derivative. How do you value the book? Do you value the book on the basis of contractual terms, or do you value the book on the basis of expected terms? You know, so you've got a deposit book. You know that it's going to last on average 6.5 years. But legally, it's repayable today.
Mm-hmm.
How are you going to value it? And I think that's an important issue, because the way that people manage these things is on expected maturity, it's not on legal maturity.
Absolutely.
Can I answer your first question about the credit risk? What we're saying here is that just by something being managed dynamically for a particular risk,
yes,
such as interest rate risk, the revaluation would only be for the interest rate risk. How you manage the... whether you had to include credit risk in that or not entirely depended on whether you managed it credit risk dynamically.
That's fine. It's just that the detailed papers that also sent around seem to actually go further than that, at least postulate going further, and I don't think you should go further than what you're suggesting.
We need to look at the wording. I think that's
going to... That wasn't the intention. The intention is the risk that you are dynamically managing.
I read that you'd be into valuing these books for almost any risk, and I could probably think of 5 or 6 different risks that you could in theory be hedging, but you're not going to.
No, that wasn't
the draft.
Yeah. The third, so there's a second issue about how do you value it, which I'm sure you're on top of. The third issue, and we're not talking about disclosure here, but the detailed papers do, is I think it's very important disclosing a maturity table, not just by legal maturities, but by expected maturities, because then people will understand how your book, your assets and liabilities, how you're managing it from a risk perspective, as well as what the legal are, and then you can actually link in the hedging that you're doing to your expected maturity. So I think both of those are the second is more important than the first, actually.
Yeah.
But I think the second, which is actually how you expect your deposits to mature in practice, is much more important than the fact that legally they're all due to there.
In answer to your second point then, what is included within the model is recognition that for risk management purposes, as you say, banks don't always manage everything on a contractual basis. And the classic examples that are often talked about are prepayable mortgages and also demand deposits.
Yeah.
And you'll see within the discussion paper there, we do kind of propose that the exposures that are revalued are in line with the way that they are managed. So if you are managing a prepayable mortgage book on an expected basis, then the profile of the loans that you would revalue would have that expected profile rather than the contractual profile. So that revaluation effect should match your risk management. And similarly for demand deposits, and it's kind of the opposite there. This is where you might have an overnight exposure, but you consider it to be a 5-year exposure, then within the model, then we hope we're able to revalue that as a 5-year exposure in line with risk management.
Okay. Cool.
General remarks. Current simple fair value peer measurement for derivatives may not necessarily reflect the economic reality of the entities when banks use derivatives to reduce the risk exposure on a net basis, since hedged items are recognized as amortized cost. So this project may be very complex and has various implications to other areas. So therefore, it is difficult to determine one way or the other. Some stakeholders expressed concern that this model is akin to the full fair value approach. However, it may be at least worthwhile to consider a country model that is not just for just of hedge accounting. So I support this project. Regarding the needs from other industries such as macro hedge for commodities or something, I support those needs. However, at this point, maybe the members should concentrate on the interest rate risk issues, because it is quite difficult and may take time.
Mike?
A bit like Roger, I think it's certainly an interesting approach. I think there are going to be a number of issues potentially with working this one through. We've talked a little bit about behavioralization in terms of term. I think there are issues around behavioralization in respect of interest rates. There's quite a lot of managed rates out there which actually have a behavioralization context to them, not a market rate context. So you talk about revaluing things against market rates, that ain't always easy. I mean, you just take credit cards in this country. As interest rates go up, your credit card rate does not go up commensurately, because there's a sort of psychological cap on how much people are prepared to pay for credit cards. So I think you've got those issues. I think you have got the challenge when it comes to that if you take, if you like, a risk management approach that says, I will consider whether or not I wish to risk manage something, and therefore, if you like, I'm including you in my scope, that by not risk managing it, I now fair value it. I'm not sure that necessarily produces the right answer. And that leads me on to the next point, which is that your model seems to imply that the purpose of risk management is a fair value purpose. And it quite often isn't. But your end result in the P&L, the way you're going to report performance, is if it was. So as a simple example, I may well wish, because I've got some either low interest yielding deposits, or I'm actually funding stuff out of equity, I may well be taking a view that I wish to preserve my interest flows over a period. So I will dynamically hedge some floating rates into fixed, if I wish to have stability of interest rates. I'm looking at it from a cash flow perspective, not from a fair value perspective. You're now forcing me to revalue that and report every time that fluctuates as a fair value movement. But that's not the way I'm thinking about it. That's not what I want my performance to be judged by. I want it to be judged by I'm achieving stability of margin over time. So I think it suffers from that major defect, that you're not thinking about what the objective of the risk management is. You're making an assumption it's always a fair value objective. And that, I think, is going to be problematic.
So before, we do have certain things on the disclosure side of the mic, which we will discuss, we can discuss, which tries to achieve partly the effect you're talking about, is that the stabilization of the NIM, because at the end of the day, that's what you're trying, we are discussing. The net interest margin, is that what we are trying to establish? Now, when you say we are putting in a revaluation approach with a focus where we're saying that is how you achieve the objective of your risk management. Now, is your comment, one of the things which you're proposing is maybe it should be looking at a cash flow approach instead of a revaluation approach, or should we be thinking it? Because there is an option in there, why I mentioned is, again, looking at what is an OCI. So instead of doing it through P&L, consider through OCI and then floating it through. Is that what you're trying to get to? Because it will help us frame the questions as well.
I think there are going to be occasions when that is going to be what people are trying to do, yes. Okay. And I think you need to be alert to that.
Consider that what you, I think, just to summarize, you're not saying it's one or there could be alternative.
One of the interesting things, and we've got, as I think some of you are aware, we've got a meeting of the EFRAG Financial Interest Working Group tomorrow. Which we're going to be listening to a number of the banks setting out what they are trying to achieve. One of the things that never ceases to fascinate me, for every single bank and every single jurisdiction, you've got a different approach to life, and that's always part of the problem when you then try and invent a simple model which then fits everything, because actually you probably end up making 90 people out of 100 unhappy, because it's only the 10 who actually adopt that approach who are happy. But that's part of the challenge, I think. But I mean, we're still at early stages of trying to think this through. But those are some of the concerns I would have, I think, in terms of the approach.
And that's come out in the outreach as well, that we know, because of sort of structural differences in balance sheets and all sorts of things, people are doing different things today, and that's why they're applying different approaches to hedge accounting even today. And so that's one of the challenges.
Well, you've got some basics, in the sense of, yes, there are an awful lot of market rate type environments out there, but there's an awful lot of managed rates, whether it's government managed rates or managed rates because of the peculiarities of the products and the markets in which people serve it, that actually it makes it quite difficult. And people legitimately, I think, adopt a different approaches to that because of the different environments in which they're operating.
So I think this is an interesting project, and I would encourage you to go ahead and issue the discussion paper and get feedback. I think it's important to have a discussion about it. In the U.S., there's not a push yet for us to study or consider macro hedging. There is a strong push for us to make improvements to hedge accounting, but not the macro hedging. One of the things, and I think your question about what your question really to us is, what questions would we encourage you to ask? I think the end result of this will be a more measurement attributes on the balance sheet, if I understand it. When I overlay the IFRS 9 improvements that we're working together on, you're going to have amortized cost, you're going to have some that are fair value through OCI, some fair value through net income. Now you're going to have these that are going to be partially fair value and partially amortized cost. So I think in doing that, there's going to be important clarification for the investors to understand both a presentation and a disclosure. I think it's important to consider what other risks should be included with this beyond interest rate risk. There's going to be foreign currency risks. Some banks, some other financial institution beyond banks may manage credit risk, and once you open this up for interest rate risk, they're going to want similar things related to other types of risks. I think it's important to also talk about what types of criteria and how you prove that you are dynamically managing your risk that you've identified, and what happens when you change. And is it possible to move instruments in and out of the thing? Because you're gonna have loans, or you're gonna have debt securities, and like under IFRS 9, you're gonna have to make a distinction on the day in which you become associated with that. Is it in the cost bucket? Is it in the OCI bucket? I presume you're gonna have to conclude that it's within this dynamic managed book, which sounds a lot like another business model distinction, and you'll have to consider what happens if facts and circumstances in the model changes. No different than what you're having to do in IFRS 9. So that I look at my notes. That's all I have.
Okay, thanks.
Tom says that's all I have.
Bing?
Yeah.
Sorry, ladies and gentlemen.
Don't touch the buttons.
I have to start also from some issue very close to the scope, because it's the most important part. The first question, I just want to confirm, one double check, what's the macro hedge, meaning of macro hedge from your side? Because the macro hedging is a macro hedging's meaning varies from one jurisdiction to another. And I noticed you used the dynamic to describe that, and that's open portfolio. I would like to say, maybe we can notice at least two important points. The first one is that's open portfolio. For same days, some out and some in, another in. This is the first characteristic. The second one is the objective is comprehensive rather than one against one. So I think at least there are two levels in it. Dynamic is only one. All you may use dynamic to describe both comprehensive and open portfolio. I'd like to describe do some further explanation to what I said. Let's consider two scenarios. The first one is quite simple, like what you illustrated in your materials, in your agenda paper. The country is really with management by banks, banking sectors. This is the first scenario. The second scenario, can you imagine a refining company? They use oil to refine gas, gasolines. And if when you buy oil, maybe there are 3 weeks in this month. Week one, you buy a tank of oil from UAE. Week two from UK. Week three, another tank from say Arab. Yeah, but you put it in the same tank farm. We call it tank farm. So how can you identify which gallon is from UAE and which gallon is from UK? So it's almost impossible to do a traditional, we call it now, general hedge. It's really hard. So that's what we call commodity open portfolio hedge. And we raised this issue at the outreach by the board in Shanghai and other cities in mainland China in 2010, I think, 2010 and also 2011. But the board is finally decided to start from the interest risk management of banking sectors. I personally don't think that's a good idea, because scenario one is much more complicated than scenario two. That's what I said. There are two levels meaning of dynamic or macro hedge. The first one is open portfolio, some in and some out. The second level is comprehensive rather than simple, rather than 1-to-1. Because let's see the page, your deck. I think page two or page three. Yeah. The objective, what you illustrated here, is to see how to manage interest rate risk, but there are lots of other risks, and nobody can be called as overwhelming. Let's think about scenario two. The cost is almost the only, even not only, it's the overwhelming factor. The risk management is aiming at. So that's a difference, totally different. So, back to my question about the scope. I would like to confirm. Are you proposing the board to make a decision what the accounting mismatch is? Let's do some explanation. According to the philosophy proposed in the agenda papers, I concerned you are extending the scope of accounting mismatch. You are not.
No, that's not the idea.
That's not the idea.
No, we're trying to use the macro hedge, and you're right. It's a bit of a difficult thing to define, but we're trying to use that as the anchor, mm-hmm. rather than accounting mismatches as such.
Very clearly understand your question regarding commodities. It is certainly going to be a question in the DP about what are the issues and how are people managing this on a portfolio basis. The focus has been interest rate because that's been the burning problem. But certainly the DP is going to raise this clearly and ask for user feedback on saying that if you want this to be extended to commodity price risk, for example, the oil price that you're talking about. Similarly, we could envisage it's possible to see that in also metal prices, if you're managing copper and other things. How should we do it? What are the things we consider? So it's not going to be restricted. That will certainly be a part of the DP.
Okay, thank you. I just want to confirm whether my understanding is right or not. Okay, the second question about scope is if... okay, no, the second one, because you have answered my questions. let's back to your inquiry. Some response to your inquiry in the report. In the very beginning, we preliminary think the rationale, the principles proposed in the agenda papers would work. Yeah, we think the principle would work.
Okay.
But a big concern is practical issues. Practical issues is supposed to be really huge. It's not a fair value. I know that's not a real fair value, but it's also based on a quite developed market conditions, and I think it's quite hard for the metal and the refining companies, and even for banks, particularly smaller banks. So that's the response to your inquiry.
Susan, thank you, Ben.
Okay, thank you. I think I certainly support the proposals. I think this is an area that under IAS 39, the banks in Australia have spent a huge amount of time and effort in putting in solutions that actually get them to accounting that they think is somewhat reflective of what they do. But that is actually a lot of time and effort to maintain. So I think there would be interest in having something which is simpler. But obviously they're all in different starting points because they've taken different approaches to date. So whether this will actually come to some practical model or not, I'm not sure. But I think there certainly will be interest from certainly the banks. One of the things I think would be really helpful is to, and perhaps it's cosmetic, perhaps it's not, but to really explain what this is, because I don't think it's hedging. I think we've sort of got a spectrum of micro hedging with things that do offset. We've got fair value option where you've got a full fair value approach where at the moment we've got restrictions that you have to actually expect to significantly reduce the mismatch. And then this is something in between where it's not assets and liabilities being the same, it's derivatives that fall fair value through profit or loss, and exposures, whatever the scope of that happens to be, having a cost basis with a fair value remeasurement of a component, and that comes to some number that would go on balance sheet with a number through P&L. So it's a hybrid measurement, and one of the criticisms of fair value hedge accounting is that you get a hybrid measurement, but I think with the general hedge accounting model, people are happy to live with that as the outcome to get to an accounting response that they think represents the economics. But if there's some better way of actually describing what this is, because I think portfolio revaluation approach project gets you some way there, but it's not a full revaluation. So I think if you can somehow explain it's a partial revaluation for a specific risk, then that would actually help people understand, is this something that they're doing or not, and would it be of interest? Because I know the banks would probably come, you know, knocking on my door to say, yes, I'd like to talk to you about this. But I think there's a broader population who also would be interested that might not think this is about them, and that would be perhaps the commodities people. I also think maybe it's not just the banks and financial institutions, and it's probably the scope of what is dynamic, because you could potentially argue that any hedging relationship is dynamic because you can trade in and out of positions whenever you wish to. And I would have concern that if this is an unrestricted option for dynamic hedging, that there would certainly be an appeal that if I don't want to go through the hoops of doing documentation and hedge effectiveness testing, albeit that it'll be less onerous under the new model, could I say I'm doing dynamic hedging and take this approach, whether it is an OCI approach or a P&L approach, without having to have that rigor around all of the additional general hedge accounting requirements. I absolutely think this should be extended to commodities and other types of risks, but also I'd like to think more about what does that mean where I've got multiple risks interacting. So what if I've got commodities and currency or credit risk, which of those remeasurements should I be doing, and how close to my risk management do I want that to be, and do I want it to be selective, that if I just want to remeasure for interest rate risk, can I just do that, or could I choose credit and interest rate? And I think that would be difficult to isolate as to what risk management truly is, as to what you'd be allowed to do. My last comment would just be, given this is fairly complex and there's some really fundamental questions here, I'd ask whether we could have an extended comment period, perhaps 6 months, to be able to come up with a reasonable response to the discussion paper.
Okay, Kim?
I think at a high level, I like the approach. I suppose if you're asking for some of the questions or initial concerns, it would be, and I think this might be what Mike was raising, around saying, well, I mean, if I've got fixed interest exposure, so effectively let's call it a fair value exposure, but if I know that I'm going to make those cash flows or receive those cash flows, you know, should my financial statements reflect the fair value risk that I'm exposed to? And I think that was some of the concern in chatting to our constituency around needing to effectively reflect one's risk management. And I think, you know, picking up on a point that Roger made as well, I must say I also was under the impression that if we had some risk management of, let's say, interest rate risk, and maybe I think it does tie in with then the scoping, but it almost then seemed to imply that I needed to then reflect the effect of, let's call it, interest rate risk management. Now maybe I was only really worried about the variable exposures that I was exposed to, and I took out derivatives to hedge economically that risk. But if it's now regarded as being, well, what is interest rate risk management, and now all of a sudden on the portfolio side I need to reflect the exposure that I have to fixed interest rates, but I haven't economically gone and hedged those because I'm quite comfortable with that position, you know, does the model therefore result in me reflecting that fair value risk on the portfolio side with nothing offsetting on the other side? And I think that certainly is going to be a concern. Now, whether or not that to say needs, well, to address it, it's all around defining the scope. Because obviously, yes, I mean, under an alternative one, well, sure. As I say, I think there is huge concern because you're going to be reflecting all of those fair value changes. So I suppose it is going to therefore have to go down to trying to limit the scope to therefore say, well, and maybe it does tie back to the accounting mismatch, that if I've got a derivative which I've taken out to economically hedge my cash flow risk, well, if I account for the derivative at fair value, I've got this accounting mismatch. But if I've got fixed interest rate exposure and I haven't done anything else, well, do I want to now fair value the portfolio, because that almost now creates something else? And maybe it's all about what is the best approach for reflecting one's risk management, and is it always, you know, in showing the fair value exposure when perhaps I was more worried about cash flow risk, but on a fixed interest rate instrument, I don't actually have that cash flow risk. So as I like the approach, but I think, I suppose, it really is in trying to refine it so that we don't perhaps end up by creating a whole lot of noise that maybe shouldn't be there in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely, Kim. The bottom line is the scope, how we drew the scope. The other interesting interaction with this that comes up is that we do have the normal hedging model. So if you look at the whole banking book, you can't hedge something twice. That's where your problem comes up, is that aspect. So obviously, how do we make this model interact with the current hedging requirements? Some of them are pretty widely used. The cash flow hedgings, which are there for the bank, will also be an issue. And I think, again, like a broken record, I think the critical part of this model will be how we give the comments and how we move with the scope. So I agree, that's how it will work.
Linda?
Just a few comments to add to what's already been said. I'm happy to hear that others have the situation where all the banks had to. I thought that was a Canadian situation and that they just like to fight. I would say it's not clear to me that this concept would actually get the biggest take up with the banks. The Canadian banks in particular are quite used to the current macro hedging or micro hedging processes and rules, and have put systems in to accommodate them. So I think that over time they'd be interested in this. It's not necessarily clear to me they would be jumping on the bandwagon right away. The other thing that occurred to me from that scenario, banking scenario, is people who actually manage interest rate and the people who manage credit rate and other risks are different people, and this would actually force them to actually have to talk to each other. It's a novel concept.
Is that good or bad?
I think it's a good thing, but I'm glad that I wouldn't have to be the chief accountant helping them do that. So it's just something that went through my mind. I think that what's interesting about this is I agree that you're dealing with behavioral as opposed to contractual terms, and as I was leaving the banking industry, they were all getting used to the fact of how they were dealing with the enhanced disclosures from EDTF and stuff, which was causing them to deal with the notion because nobody wanted to deal with disclosing behavioral information. So I think, you know, that work may already be done for you, and they may have adjusted by that point in time. The other thing I was going to, I agree with the notion that we need time to consider this, because you saw that when we first started asking questions, we were all trying to figure out what the hedge documentation was going to look like. So as soon as you call this macro hedging, we're all going there. And the other thing I will warn you about is the insurance folks are actively asking about the status of macro hedging. So there is some interest.
Roger, did you want to get in again? Or?
Just a real quickie, and apologies if this is in the detailed papers, but I read them when they came out and I haven't read them since. Most banks and probably other companies as well are actually going to place these hedges through their trading book, and that adds a further complication. And I think it's probably worth asking questions about the practicalities of that. This course, that trading division may not even decide to actually place that fully out.
Yes.
And this wouldn't just apply to interest rate risk. I mean, you can imagine, for example, a utility purchasing gas, it might actually do its hedging through its trading arm, and there that trading arm is taking its own position on hedging gas prices. So it just adds to another complication.
It does, and we have addressed that. That's certainly one of the questions coming up is when you have internal derivatives. Some occasion it'll cancel out, but if you look at OCI, we have a small issue about how the presentation and thing goes. But yes, Roger, we are cognizant. We have put that in there.
Okay.
Yes, I was on. Very quick. It's to come in on my on Mike said. I believe that for the time being, it should be interesting to leave the two options open, offer some sort of cash flow portfolio approach and a fair value portfolio approach. I never thought of a cash flow portfolio approach, but I think that's going to be interesting to see what people think about it.
Probably all very hungry. I just get news that lunch hasn't arrived yet.
Oh no!
Now 3 minutes from the office, and then they'll have to set it up. So we have to fill the time with chatting along. On. So that bring up some new problems.
We want to touch on presentation at all.
Why don't you?
The presentation alternatives that will be included in the paper. For what it would actually look like when you pick up the set of financial statements.
Yeah, I don't know whether there is something that we put in here, actually. Okay, well, in terms of income statement presentation, we within the discussion paper, there are going to be two alternatives. One, if I remember the name correctly, is the actual net interest rate approach, and the other one is a stable net interest rate approach. And I think from discussions at the board and also from outreach we've done, there seems to be much more support for the actual net interest margin approach rather than the stable one. But just to explain what we mean is for the actual net interest margin approach, then we would have three different lines making up net interest margin. There would be the normal interest revenue, which would be your income recognition from all your exposures as they would normally be accounted for. So if they're kind of financial instruments, that would be under IFRS 9, obviously. And then you'd have interest expense as well, which similarly would be all your kind of yield from your managed exposures as well. And then the additional line would be called something like net interest income from risk management instruments. So within that third line, that would be all the what you might think of as typical accrual income from your risk management derivatives. And so the advantage that we see of this model is that, firstly, you know, there's no change to your income recognition for your managed exposure, so operationally that's quite easy. But also it kind of very clearly shows the before and after effect of your risk management. So you see, you know, what was the natural yield from your portfolio and how have you transformed that by your net interest from risk management instruments, and that gets down to your net income. Then we've got the revaluation effect, and the proposal there is that there would be it would end up being all the clean revaluations of your exposures and the clean fair value from your derivatives would all be in one net revaluation line that clearly shows this is the revaluation effect from my risk management. So that's the actual approach. The stable approach, I think, that is by its name, it kind of has the assumption really that banks do have an objective to fully stabilise their net interest margin. And I think as we've more and more we've talked to banks, we've kind of realised that that's not kind of the case. And so what this does is it kind of tries to, you know, it says, well, if you are doing this, if you are dynamically managing your portfolio and your objective is to stabilise your margin, then let's show what, if you've done a perfect hedge, then your net interest income and expense, that would show what would that have looked like if you had achieved that objective to stabilise the margin entirely. And so in that instance, then all that the net interest margin would really show would be the credit margins, I suppose, that you would have achieved on your assets and liabilities. So it really that would be the best thing about it, because it would show clearly what your margins have achieved rather than your interest rate management. But I think the difficulty of this is that it is quite a big change from operationally from what's done at the moment. I think it doesn't necessarily show what has actually happened for risk management. So I can, I understand why it's less popular. And then the balance sheet. The balance sheet, we've got three different alternatives. And the first one is a kind of a line by line revaluation approach. And this is very similar to what you might expect for, say, a fair value hedge. And this is where once you've calculated the revaluation adjustment for all the different exposures, then you would adjust the carrying amount for the exposures by that revaluation amount. So each line where there was exposures included within the portfolio would be adjusted for the revaluation with respect to the hedged risk. So that's basically kind of grossing up, I suppose, the effect of the revaluation. The next alternative was where, for all managed assets within the portfolio, you would aggregate the revaluation of all those managed assets into a single line, and similarly you would have the revaluation effect of all your liabilities within a single line. And then the third one was that you would just have a single revaluation that showed the net revaluation position within your balance sheet. And I think through discussions, I mean, there's kind of, yeah, I don't think there's a clear winner on this, but I think the kind of the views that have been expressed are along the lines of, well, if you are managing it on a net risk basis, then representing that in the balance sheet on a net risk is helpful. I think operationally it's been raised that it might be difficult to allocate it to a line by line basis anyway. I think some investors have actually said that they find it too confusing to have it on a line by line basis, because what they really want to see is the amortized cost. But then others have said, well, you know, it's great to have the revaluation effect, but actually perhaps I'm quite interested in knowing where that revaluation has come from. You know, where's your main interest rate positions? Is it mostly on a behaviourised deposit basis? So there are kind of variations in views, I think, as to which of those alternatives are optimal. And this is one of the questions that we raise in the discussion paper, both on the income statement and the balance sheet, to get views on, you know, which are the most helpful kind of presentations.
I think during the comment period, to the extent that you can help us get access to people in your different regions, particularly corporates as opposed to financial institutions so that we can get some more information on the sort of other risks other than interest rate risk, because that's where we've really struggled so far to get people to engage. That would be very much appreciated.
Mike?
What's the likely timing on the DP?
Our target is to publish it before the end of the year. I think it'll be very late in the year.
In which case, I think you need to definitely allow a very extended time for commentary. Because you've got to remember the first,
this time
the
will
first
get
two
it.
Or 3 months is going to be knocked
what
out.
What does very extended mean to you, 180 days?
180 days.
That because people aren't going to focus on it for the first 2 months.
That's some going to, we'll ask the board about that in October, but our staff recommendation will be 180 days.
To help you continue to stall before lunch. I apologize if this is in the things and I missed it, but is this applicable if you're measuring the asset at fair value OCI? Or only at fair value, only at cost? And if it's fair value OCI, do you, because the balance sheet, does the balance sheet stay at fair value and the amount that goes to net income is the interest rate or the hedge, the risk? That's the way it would work?
Yeah, I think we haven't looked at it in specifically, but I think the intention would be that it would apply to fair value OCI on the basis that one of the assuming that exists, of course, because it still has to be re-deliberated.
Yes. thanks for that qualifier.
But if we...
yes, that overlay has
to Because I'm sitting next to Steve, I have to be careful, he might hit me. Given that our logic from the ISB side was that the P&L would look the same for fair value OCI and amortized cost, I think it would make sense for it to apply. But then, yeah, the mechanics become quite tricky.
Yeah, so that now you have five different ways to account for the same thing. And that's why presentation is going to be so important.
You could always go back to a cool accounting derivative, it might solve everything.
Sometimes you wonder. It makes you wonder.
If we're still stalling, just on Jane's comment on presentation, and really back to what
well,
I said.
We're not stalling anymore. All right. Finish your question.
Very quick. So just on the net presentation proposal, I think that would also muddy the issue that we'd have revaluation of fair value and a partial revaluation, and if they're mixed in the same number, you're not actually giving a meaningful number if you present it combined.
I don't think we're suggesting you present the derivatives and the exposures together. The derivatives would clearly be fair value through P&L in the derivatives line. Then there'd be a separate line reflecting the net revaluation of the exposures without the derivatives.
Okay, 1 o'clock. We meet again.